Hey everybody, this is DJ Q for the Golf News Net Radio Network. We now return you to Jay's Plays Already in Progress.
All right, thank you, DJ Q, for bringing us back from break in style. He's right, I am Jay Flemma, and you're listening to Jay's Plays on the Golf News Net Radio Network. Thanks for staying with us, everybody. We had Ryan Ballingy on for the first segment, and also we have a Lifetime Achievement Award winner from the PGA of America, a man who's covered 50 years of sports worldwide, seen everything, been everywhere, written about it all. We just had him at the PGA Championship, but he's covered everything from Super Bowls to Wimbledon to the Lower Oakland Roller Derby Finals. Well, maybe not that last one. Please welcome back a warm Jay's Plays welcome for Art Stander. Art, thanks for being on the show.
Welcome.
So, you know, you've been doing this for 50 years, so take a couple minutes and tell us some stories about the greatest things that you saw through your eyes.
Well, that's obviously, you know, it's hard. But let me tell you, I was there. I covered the 1980 Winter Olympics at Lake Placid when the U.S. beat the Soviet Union, and that was about as emotional event. We don't find that anymore. The U.S., our sports are internal. It's more important that the 49ers beat the Giants or the Red Sox beat the Yankees than the U.S. beat Britain in soccer or something like that, or as they call it, football. But because of the emotion tied to it, the fact that the Soviet Union, which was about to be falling apart, as we know, a few years later, had invaded Afghanistan, and the U.S. is playing the Soviet Union, and the Soviet Union has the world's best hockey players, many of whom came to the NHL within a few years after that, if not immediately, are playing basically amateurs from the U.S., and the U.S. upsets them in this little high school gym and high school arena at Lake Placid. And it was just incredibly emotional. I can't remember anything quite like that, but I've been to 62 Rose Bowls, and there's a little caveat there. As a kid in LA, I started selling programs in 1954. I've gone to every one since then. I've covered the last, 52 in a row. And so I've seen a lot of great football games. I've got World Series, home runs, et cetera. And tennis tournaments, you know, great. Watching Sampras at his best, watching Nadal, these guys. I am not really a tennis guy. I cover a little bit, but when I started going to the British Open, the Open Championship, I decided, hey, it's the same time as Wimbledon. I might as well do both. What I appreciate is the hand-eye coordination. People who say it's a sissy sport ought to watch it. 2 years ago at the U.S. Open, Nadal and Djokovic were in the finals, and they had I believe it was a 55-shot rally. They hit the ball so hard, I don't even know how they get to it, much less return it. And my appreciation, I just say, wow, how do they do that? And that's, as you mentioned, I've been doing this 55 years professionally, a lot of golf, a lot of everything, World Series, Winter Olympics, Summer Olympics, L.A., people say, don't you get bored? And sometimes, and I imagine Ryan will agree, we've heard it all, and you say, we roll our eyes, and yet when somebody performs at the ultimate, and I appreciate that so much, it's just like watching a great dancer or violin player. Let me just, one more story, and I'll relate. I used to be, and I know, Jay, you're in music, but my mom wanted me to be a classical violinist. And so I played the violin from the time I was 6 years old to the time I was out of high school. And I was like at the best, a double A, or maybe a single A. I just didn't have it. You got to have the same coordination and skill that you do to play tennis and golf and baseball and football, to play violin. But I was at, we have symphony tickets, and this is 10 years ago, and I was sitting at intermission at San Francisco Symphony, and a guy who recognized me came up and said, this you know, 16, 17-year-old Chinese violinist, and she was just playing just out of her mind, and like I, wow, I'm going, is that unbelievable? And this guy recognizes me and says, how do you compare her to Barry Bonds? And I said, she's exactly the same. She grew up, she has the talent, and then she worked very hard, perfect it. So people, unless they're real jerks in their profession, I just admire people who achieve at a high level. And particularly, yes, you can be born with talent, but as you well know, you have to go out and work on it. And people, and so you get what you've put in to the sport or to the violin or anything else.
You know, it's interesting you should say that, because my grandmother wanted my father to be a classical violinist, but he only played the violin for a year and a half because when he refused to practice, she broke it over his head. And my father's first thought, he told me, was, good, now I don't have to do that anymore. But I do agree with you, Art, that, you know, it's really special to watch the greatest athletes in the world at their biggest moments. As Hank Gola likes to say, we're underpaid, but we're overprivileged. Now, I remember my first big tournament that I covered as a professional journalist when I went to the 2005 U.S. Open at Pinehurst. It was a bit of a pinch-me moment. You know, I was excited, but at the same time walking into that room, seeing the size of it, you know, being overwhelmed by the fact that any statistic I could possibly need was at my command. They would bring it to me, including transcripts. You know, sitting there in the interview room and, you know, they're bringing in all of the great names that, you know, used to be on my TV and now they're right in front of me. What was your first big tournament that you covered? And was it a bit of a pinch-me moment for you?
You're asking me. It was the 66 U.S. Open. I had come up to the San Francisco Chronicle from the Santa Monica Evening Outlook, which doesn't exist anymore. And I was just basically working the desk and I wanted to do something. And we had three younger guys. And this was 50 years ago. And they used to let you play golf on the San Francisco City courses for free with a press card. So we worked the night desk, so we went out in a couple of days a week and play golf. And we'd come in and we'd talk golf, as golfers always do. You know, and stupid shot you hit there, oh, was I awful, et cetera. And so when they needed a golf writer, they made me the golf writer. And that was the fall of 65, I guess, or the spring of 66. So I got to cover only, not the lead, a sidebar, at the 66 U.S. Open at Olympic Club. And there were two things. One, Johnny Miller was a 19-year-old amateur, and they said, your job is to cover Miller. He was playing with two guys I'd never heard of, Harry Toscano, who I got to meet, and Lee Trevino. A lot of people think the 67 Open was Trevino's first, but no, he played in the 66 Open, and he made the cut. And the other thing was, I walked all 18 holes with Palmer and Casper, the final regular round. And Arnie, of course, had a 7-shot lead at one time and a 6-shot lead with 6 holes to play, and was lucky to get into a playoff with Billy and then lost the playoff, the 18-hole playoff. But that made an incredible impression. So there isn't, you know, I've seen, obviously, all these masters. I saw Nicklaus win. That was wonderful. Ben Crenshaw win when he starts crying and things like that. And the British Opens and Tiger's wonderful scores over the years at both at Pebble Beach and at St. Andrews. But I think that first Open will always stay there because one, it was sort of a home course, 20 miles from where I live. And it was the two of the three great golfers then playing the game, going at each other head-to-head.
Now, you mentioned that Open and the terrible collapse. I also witnessed a terrible collapse, and you did too, when we watched Phil Mickelson fall out of the sky at Wingfoot. He had a 3-shot lead with 3 holes to play and ended up squandering it, you know, by hitting into 2 bunkers, you know, and 2 trees and a garbage can and a merchandise tent. But I remember on 18 when he sliced his drive into the wrong fairway. I was up above the 18th green in the second story of the locker room. And when Phil hit the tree with his second shot, I couldn't, you know, it was just one of those things that just came out and blurted out as I looked at the camera and I said, my God, we're watching a snuff film. And I knew right there that Phil was done. At what moment when you were watching Palmer and Casper, at what moment did you look at Palmer and say, my God, he's not going to win this thing?
Well, I never thought that. In fact, with nine holes to go, I turned to the guy with a seven-shot differential and said, there won't be a playoff this year. And, of course, there wasn't.
Oh, there's the jinx right there. I never say the B word.
Hogan and Fleck, 55. They've had some – it's funny. The, quote, wrong guy always wins the Open at Olympic Club, or the underestimated person. And Fleck – and the most famous is Fleck beats Hogan. The driving range pro with playing Hogan clubs beats him in 55. And then in 66, I mean, Billy Casper was a great golfer. He won at Winged Foot. And, in fact, Nicholas said to me, I remember 74, I was when they played the Massacre Open, and reaction to Johnny Miller's 63 the year before at Oakmont, where we're going shortly, but Jack said, gee, I didn't realize Billy could play this well. Like, nobody plays as well as I do. And I said, Jack, he already won an Open, and then, of course, he was going to win a Masters. He beat his San Diego pal, Gene Littler, in a playoff, the 18-hole playoff they used to play. I'm, unfortunately, old enough to have seen 18-hole playoffs in all four majors, including Don January against Don Massengale at Columbine in 1967. That'll shake you up.
Well, there's a sure bar bet winner, okay, because I can name every U.S. Open winner, and, of course, they won on from 1939 forward, including the hard ones like Ed Fergal in 54 at Baltusrol and Orville Moody champions in 69. But I would have been stumped to a brick to try to figure out that one. I didn't even know where Columbine Golf Course is, and I had forgotten that Don January did actually win a major. So
yeah,
now
the late Al.
I've also go ahead.
Wright, who wrote for Sports Illustrated, preceded Dan Jenkins, and of course they had to get it in early. He said, are you going to stay for the playoff? And I said, of course. He said, I'm not. I'm leaving. So he left. And so
I do have to say that I took a look at the leaderboard a couple of times. So we talked about what a great leaderboard we had last week. But for a while, we had a pot of haggis on the leaderboard. Okay, it took Spieth and Day and Justin Rose and Martin Keimer, you know, until late in the third round, the back nine of the third round to rise up. But we were looking at guys like Tony Finau and Matt Jones. Not nothing to take anything away from Tony Finau and Matt Jones, but they don't move the needle like Spieth and Day do. As, you know, Jenkins likes to say, we want to have a proper winner. The nice thing about Day is that I think we're going to see another major or two out of him. Now, I'll bring up Tony Finau for just one reason. Maybe it's me. Okay, it probably is, but speaking both as an entertainment lawyer, an intellectual property and sports lawyer, as well as a journalist, I had a big problem with a guy who was on a reality show winning the PGA Championship or any other major. I'm sure it would be a great story, but anything that empowers, you know, reality TV frightens me terribly.
Well, you know, once again, these guys, you couldn't, if you weren't a great golfer, you wouldn't be on tour. And you hear amateurs who have a great round say, you know, I think I'm going on tour. I said, you don't know how good these people are. And I remember one day watching, and I'm trying to think of who it was. It was a rainy day at the Colonial, and so the round was being held up and guys were practicing. And whoever I was talking to was hitting shots out of the bunker. And one, you know, practice bunker and a damp, soaking practice bunker. And he was just flipping the ball up. And each one was in 4 inches, 5 inches, 3 inches, couple in the cup. And I'm saying, wow. And then I'm thinking to myself, if they couldn't do that, they wouldn't be on tour. And that's why, once again, and it's in every other game, too. you know, there's minor leagues. You see the difference when people go from AAA to the majors. And you see the difference when they go from college football to the NFL. Well, this is the NFL and the majors and everything else. That's the way golf is. And the people, I mean, look how many great players are on tour and can't even win. And so just to win any tournament is special, and to win a major is tremendous. So I have, you're always going to have people that slip in the finals and those guys. And so there's
and
nothing
the
wrong with that.
And the Michael Campbells and such, and the Lucas Glovers and such.
Yeah, yeah. But once again, you have upsets in all sports. And I don't know if the, it's fair to call it an upset, because once again, they're playing their game and nobody can stop them.
Now, what is, you know, we'll get you from you, the most shocking thing that you've seen, perhaps the most shocking collapse in sports, and then tell us the flat-out funniest thing that you've seen, or maybe a bunch of them in the 50 years you cover sports.
Well, the collapse, I've seen some basketball collapses. I mean, UCLA, which is my alma mater, which was running, was going to win the 1974 championship and had the lead, and David Thompson, North Carolina State, beat them after they'd won all these games in a row. And once in a while, the ball doesn't go in the basket, it doesn't go in the cup, it doesn't go in the hands of the receiver. And so what else? I'm trying to think. Big upsets. You know, people, I've done a lot of NCAA Final Fours, and when Villanova beat, was it Georgetown? Yeah.
Oh, yeah, it was Georgetown.
Yeah, and they made what? Villanova made every shot but one in the second half. That doesn't happen, but it did.
9 of 10 from the field in the second half.
Right. And you know, it's, okay, the 49ers, they're going for the third straight Super Bowl. They have the lead against the New York Giants in the, here at Candlestick Park, in the NFC Championship game, and Roger Craig fumbles because Steve Young has been called in to play quarterback because Montana got hurt. And the next thing is the Giants kick a field goal. I think they won the game on 5 field goals, if I remember.
Yeah,
that was 1990.
That's right.
And that's why nobody's won 3 Super Bowls in a row, the most anybody's ever won is 2 in a row. Once again, you need all the breaks. You got to be a great player, and golf is just amazing. I give Jason Day a lot of credit. I'm digressing here, but he didn't play it safe coming home. At 18, he went for it. He's, in other words, he just felt, look, I'm in control, and I'm just going to keep going, and he did. And so when you know, Jordan Spieth talked about being in the zone. When if you get in the zone, I don't know if there is a zone, but basically when everything you do is what you want to do, the San Francisco Giants, and of course I'm obviously living in the Bay Area, I'm familiar with the NorCal teams, but I go to the Super Bowl every year. I know what the New York Giants do and the Red Sox and the Patriots and everything. But San Francisco Giants 3 years ago came back down 2-1 to the Cardinals, who happen to be playing right now, and they gave up 9 runs in the last 6 games. And I always think of what the late John McKay, the coach at USC, who then became the first coach of the Tampa Bay Bucks, told me. He says, defense wins, because if the other team doesn't score, the worst you'll ever get is a nothing-nothing tie. Now, that doesn't work in golf, because you can't play defense. But you just look at all the other sports, even in tennis. If you can return serve, you know, that's defense. And in basketball, they shut you down. In hockey, the goalie wins. In baseball, pitching wins. And the Patriots, everybody talked about the Seahawks 2 years ago and what a great defense. The Patriots won the last Super Bowl on defense. The great interception at the end. So, yeah, I mean, you just watch all these things and appreciate. Funniest, it's hard. I really haven't seen very much, and I don't like to embarrass people. I saw Jack Nicklaus top a tee shot once. I mean, hit a tee shot 30 yards.
How did he do that, and where was that?
He just, like, jumped out of the car in a pro-am and hit the ball 20 yards. And it's like, what? So,
and what did he do after that happened?
Then he hits a great shot. And that's another thing pro golfers do. They may hit one bad shot, but they don't follow it up like the amateurs do with a lot of bad shots. You know, Dave Stockton, who I got to know very well and still know very well, has become famous for teaching putting. But he's a great short game player. And I didn't realize. He said I couldn't even hit the ball 225 yards when I played the regular tour. But he could get it up and down every time from 100 yards. So,
oh, yeah, from the deck of a sinking ship. He was famous for that.
Does that build confidence? Of course. And when the other guy misses and three putts, he loses confidence. And, see, the wonderful thing about golf is a one-foot putt counts the same amount of shots as a 300-yard drive. You're not going to miss many one-foot putts, but occasionally you do. And so that's what balances the game out. Now, Jason Day had an advantage because he hits the ball, say, farther than Jordan Spieth. But Jordan Spieth's short game was wonderful, and he made a run. I mean, you know, once again, we have probably seen as close as anybody. Arnie won the first two in 1960. Jack won the first two in 1972. And Jordan Spieth won the first two in 2015 of the majors. And each of them lost the third by a single shot. Nicholas.
That's right. Even Woods didn't do that. Woods got blown away at Muirfield.
On 17, holes out a shot out of the weeds. You're probably never going to see anybody win the slam. And I doubt you're going to see anybody win the first three. Yes, we've seen people win three. Hogan did it in a different era. And, of course, he had to take a boat back from the British Open. And Tiger won the last three in 2000. But I don't think you're going to see anybody win the first three. The depth of field is too tremendous. I mean, look, Matt Kuchar is a wonderful golfer. He's never won a major. Who else? Guys that haven't won majors.
Lee Westwood.
Yeah, Lee Westwood. He never will win a major, but he led the Masters, and he led the British Open.
Well, his window is closing, but at an Open Championship, that's the one tournament, you know, with the weather and the wind, that a wily old veteran stands just as much of a chance. Darren Clark won, and Greg Norman and Tom Watson scared the claret jug.
Well, yeah, I'll tell you what. Tom Watson, who I covered from the time he was a freshman at Stanford, 1967-68. He played in the San Francisco City. That's how I got to know him, and I was the golf writer then. But nope, that would have been the greatest story in sports, a 59-year-old man winning a major, winning the British Open. And, of course, you can do it because you can run the ball. It can bounce it up. And of course, the gods or his game caught up with him on the 72nd hole. It was a shame, but it was a great run, and it was memorable. And this year he played his final Open, and it's not there anymore. He's what is he, 70? I'm trying to think. 65.
65. He's 65. Tom is 85. And Nicholas is 75.
Yeah.
They're all
yeah.
10 years apart.
And Artie's 85, 86. And, yeah. I mean, you know, father time, this isn't true in every sport. Father time wins every game.
Well, the same thing's going to be true of me someday, I'm sure. I hope that I can last 50 years. I love this job. You know, it's the one thing that I can say, Art, that I can stand toe-to-toe with any of you guys is that I have the love for this. I'll bring it every single time I come out. You know, we all talk about this in the media center, but we love doing this job. I mean, I love to write. I love to sit down and string together one good word at a time, one good story at a time. And I'll tell you one Tom Watson story to kick us out of here with a laugh. Maybe you remember this, okay? Were you in the interview room when Tom Watson did the pre-tournament interview at the U.S. Open at Pebble Beach in 2010?
I don't remember. I was at the Open, certainly, and I've been at a lot of pre-tournament, but I can't even remember if I was in the interview room, which we were
mild. Well, when I tell this story, you'll remember whether you were there or not, because okay. This one, you never forget this. So I had made arrangements with Watson to interview him because I have a couple of gold nuggets in my golf library. I have a bunch of the old USGA programs from the early 80s. And these things are three times the size of the ones that they give out now. That's where I read some articles of yours. You were on my nightstand as a kid, as was my buddy Marino Paracenzo. I'll never forget your intro to some British Open at Royal Living when you said, the clubhouse at Royal Living looks like Castle Dracula, but if you really want to get scared, go look at the golf course. But anyway, I had made arrangements to meet with Watson to talk to him about a piece that he wrote in the 83 open program, a play-by-play, blow-by-blow of every shot of the back nine. And it was just fascinating. It became one of the centerpieces of my preview. And everybody, you should run and go read that. CyberGolf's still up on my website. Just go to, June of 2010, you'll find it. But anyway, Watson and I talked on the phone, but we hadn't met. Now, everyone's waiting for Tom to come in through the front door where the dais is and take his place. So we're all looking that way, and so nobody noticed him sneak in through the back. So he's making his way up the aisle, and meanwhile, I'm reading the interview so that I can think of a question to ask him while we're sitting there. And so he comes up from behind and puts his arm over and goes, hey, what you reading? The whole room's waiting for him to come up and take his seat, and he comes out and talks to me. So we chat for a second, then he goes up and he takes his seat, and it was Beth Major, it might have been Craig Smith, but somebody said to him, yeah, we were expecting you to come through the other way. And he looks and he says, oh no, baby, I come in through the back door. I'm a back door man. There's a horrible silence. That line goes over everyone. And then he starts singing like Jim Morrison. Hey now, baby. I'm a backdoor man. The room erupts in laughter. Tom McGinty from the Irish Times or Irish Sun sitting next to me with Dermot Galise. One of the two of them says, did I just drink a bottle of whiskey and not know it? We've been laughing in hysterics, at Watson's wonderful humanity. So you're right. It was a terrible day, the day that the golf gods sort of either looked the other way or decided to play a nasty trick on us, one or the other. We may never see that again. Who knows, I think there's one inalienable truth about sports, is that it is cyclical. We say we'll never see the likes of him again, and yet another one always comes. We'll never see another Hoagland, but then comes Nicklaus. We'll never see another Lucas, then there comes Woods. We'll never see another Woods. We don't know who it's going to be. But records are made to be broken. We as humans are getting bigger, stronger, and faster. Do you think that maybe all we sometimes have to do as sports writers is just let the story happen and remind people, to take a step back rather than say that everything that we're seeing this second, like Bill Walton, is the greatest thing on earth?
Well, one of the problems is that because television is so important, ESPN particularly, which dominates sports, the networks want the viewer to think what he or she is watching is the most important thing that ever happened. And it isn't always. In other words, they treat the Little League World Series, which I wish wasn't on TV, but it is, because then 11-year-old and 12-year-old kids get big heads. But everything, if you think, I got to watch this. So you sometimes, the younger generation is kept outside the fact that these things happened over the years. And it's one of the things I've always liked about golf is that the top golfers have a sense of history. Whether it was Ben Crenshaw, whether it was Spieth talking about Hogan, all these guys, whether it was Tiger talking about Nicklaus and Palmer, all these kids grew up with a sense of who they're chasing, who was great in the game. You don't find it as often in football and baseball. As you know, so many African-American players, and there aren't a lot of them now, didn't even know who Jackie Robinson was until Major League Baseball emphasized Jackie Robinson retiring 42, et cetera, et cetera. But, the games have been around for years. And And obviously, today's athletes are better than they've ever been. They eat better. They practice better. They keep themselves in shape. There's better medical advice. But I think that you have to go, you talk about the eras, you have to go by the era. You have to, you know, you've heard this over the years. Could Marciano beat Clay or Ali? And it doesn't matter. I mean, it's great for argument. And so when Tiger was eating up Southern Hills in 07, the PGA, a golfer I know who's playing in the, and then is now retired, said Tiger would send Bobby Jones to the woodshed. And I said, that's an unfair statement, because he they're playing in different eras. And did Bobby Jones beat everybody he had to again when he played? Yes. Did Tiger beat everybody he had to when he played? Yes. So that's how you have to go. And it's fun to argue whether the 27 Yankees could have beaten the 49 Yankees, or whether the Steelers could have beaten the Patriots, or Steelers from the 80s could have beaten the Patriots. That's part of sports. But there's no way to prove it, and you don't have to. You just say, hey, look, these guys are all great. You know, Babe Ditrickson, Zaharias, may have been the greatest athlete of all time. I'll tell you who I think is the greatest athlete of all time, since is Jackie Robinson, who I got to meet a little bit. You know, at UCLA, he played four sports. His fourth sport was baseball. He led the nation. He led the nation in scoring in basketball, and he played basketball, ran track, played baseball, and played football. And you never hear about that. So, was he pretty good? Yeah. Once again, he played in 39 and 40. Was the world? Yes, it is, and yes, it was.
Well, Art, it's been fantastic having you on the show. I can't thank you enough for your time. You know, it's always great to have the legends. Everybody, Art Spanner of the Oakland Tribune and the San Francisco Examiner. And we will be right back with more Jay's Plays after this. You're listening to Jay Flemmer on the Golf News Net Radio Network.
We're at the end of another great Jay's Plays show, but thank you all so much for joining in. It's no fun doing this to an empty room, but it sure is fun doing it for all of you guys, so thanks so much. I want to thank Fish for kindly letting me use their great music as a theme song for the show. Thanks, guys. I want to thank CyberGolf and Golf News Network, cybergolf.com/writerscorner, including me and all the other fine writers, and thegolfnewsnet.com/radio. Take us home, DJ Q.
Tune in next time for another great Jay's Play show on the Golf News Net Radio Network.
Thanks, guys. Catch y'all next time.